that Joseph Agassiz talk? I don't know.
I listened to the first like 25 minutes and then I had to go to bed. But some people seemed like super, super into it. So I'm wondering if I, does he like get into some crazy stuff? Like he's got some cool anecdotes and stuff. I don't see anything crazy yet. I don't know.
The thing that jumped out at me is like some of his very pithy comments that almost were like non-explanations land to like deep Popperians, of which nice. I am one. Because it just made me so curious to start reading his work. And his work is fantastic.
Is he, so he's like, touts himself as a pretty good writer. So is he a good writer? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So not only is he a good writer, but he has good writing advice.
Nice.
Which I've just been reading. And one of his pieces of advice is like, just get rid of the entire like essay format. This is a terrible way to teach like undergraduates to learn to write.
Huh?
And it's much better to say to them, and I think this is great, to like write dialectically, which is choose some controversy that you're interested in, and then just summarize the arguments on both sides.
Interesting.
And that's the initial writing advice. And it's not to be original. It's not to be like clever. It's not to try to come up with an original thesis, because when you're learning to write, you first need to learn to research. So I'm like going through his memoir right now, and Popper totally was a dick, but like in a way that I thought was very humanizing. Like, he's just a guy, right? Like a guy with like anger issues and insecurities and all of the things that come with like just being a dude writing about stuff.
Wanting your ideas to be taken seriously and not having them taken seriously.
And being like bitter about it.
I just finished Wittgenstein's Poker.
Oh, did you?
Like an account of...
Yeah.
It's pretty good. I mean, he can't actually say... It's an interesting book because he can't say much about the event itself. So most of it is like historical context, background, biographical information about Popper and Wittgenstein. All of which was like super interesting to me. And just like the whole Vienna Circle context and Popper like, you know, getting mad and thinking he proved them wrong, but them not taking him seriously, and him like... proving them wrong, but also wanting to be part of the circle, like, you know, wanting to be in there, but them not taking him seriously, and then him, just like quirks of his personality, right? Like things he like maybe took credit for that maybe weren't all of his doing, and him just being an asshole of a supervisor, like made his students' lives nightmarish.
Yeah.
And
I definitely want to read that one, because that's like when Wittgenstein grabbed the poker and was like pointing it at Popper during like the argument about like philosophical problems and stuff. Was it?
Yeah, so it was like this thing in Cambridge, and Wittgenstein was the head, the person who ran the club. It was just like a reading group for philosophy, and they invited Popper, and Popper's. I mean, at that point, their whole clash was like, are there philosophical problems, right? Wittgenstein was like, it's just language puzzles. And so Popper's whole point of his talk was like, there are real problems. And they just like got so, but they had a history up till that point. They like knew about each other.
Yeah.
And so it was fiery, like right off the bat. And so the author does like a really good job, which is like setting up the scene and making it all intense and then diving into the history. And I recommend it.
That's fantastic. I definitely want to, because you're also saying that like, you don't recommend Sapolsky's book.
Oh yeah, dude, it's terrible. It was sad. It was sad for me to, I listened to it. It's bad. It's just bad, dude. It's a terrible book. His course, I think it's because he doesn't have enough time to like go deeply into the studies, right? You're lecturing to people. You can't just start reciting studies at them. So instead you talk about the principles, right? And I think a lot of the principles of what he's talking about stand. Like, you know, in general, it's not like the replication crisis has evaporated the claim that like shit is complicated when it comes to gene environment interaction, right? Like that hasn't been dismantled at all, but it's been like these very particular studies about like implicit biases and like priming effects and like how easily we can be, you know, just like all this stuff is just garbage. But his book dives into that stuff so deeply that it's like, it's hard to get around when you're a reader and you're like, oh dude, like all of this stuff. And he's using it as like, look, you know, this is horrible. Look at these concrete examples of humans having all these biases and these tendencies and stuff. And it's just like, oh, you got to rewrite this, man. Like, like all the super bunk ones too. Like he's talking about power poses. He's talking about the one where like people are more take hurricanes that are named male-named hurricanes. Those bad. More serious. Seriously, he's like talking about like the implicit bias stuff. It hasn't been like completely falsified, but a lot of it is like seriously overblown. And like he relies on that like a lot. Anyway, there's just like a whole, I was like jotting down a list of like all the shit that's wrong.
My
Oh, yeah.
If I was to guess, I think that like Sapolsky, I've learned so much from him and he's amazing, but he's one of the things he's really great at is telling stories, right? So I think a lot of what probably has gone into his book is the stories he's developed over like 30 years of teaching as he is communicating these ideas to his students and like refining the story and stuff. And like, this is the thing that I remember, like, I think it's on The Very Bad Wizards where they're talking about like, they can't really talk about the Milgram experiments anymore or the Zimbardo experiments because both of them are like now just out of date. And it's too bad because the stories are so good, right?
Yeah.
And
you want to lock people bunch up in a prison and crazy shit happens.
Yeah. And you want to be able to keep telling these stories. And and so I would imagine there's some of that happening too, where like Sapolsky has just refined the story around a lot of these studies so well over his like 10-year teaching career. That when he goes to write them all down, he's just transcribing basically what he's practiced saying out loud. But then the replication crisis just kills all these stories. Like, and you have to just let them die, or at least like caveat them and like that, like I think in the case of Zimbardo, like didn't he just lie about a lot of the research?
Yeah, the Stanford Prison Experiment one, he just told the guards to be mean, to be like kind of ruthless, and so you could still come up with a story there, like oh they didn't have to be mean as they were, et cetera, but he definitely played like an influential role in telling them to like humiliate the stuff. So that's definitely a confounding factor if there ever was one.
Yeah, to say the least.
Dial one. It was Zimbardo, you said.
Yeah, so Milgram is definitely the Dial one, and Zimbardo is the Stanford Prison Experiment. But yeah, the one with Milgram is like, you have an actor who is attached to some wires, and the actual person who the experiment's being run on is being told to just keep increasing the shocks. It's like a fake teaching strategy or something, just keep shocking this guy. And then the conclusion is that like when you are an authority figure telling someone to crank up the pain, they'll just do it obediently.
Right.
But I guess I learned about this from Radiolab, actually. They did a good follow-up on this, which is that I guess when you have like two experiments, so there's all sorts of variations done that Milgram himself did. And so if you have like an experimenter wearing like just ordinary person clothes, the obedience rates like change
instead
entirely.
Of a lab coat.
Or if you have like, if you have like two or three authority figures who are like arguing with themselves, the obedience rates change. So it's not at all as simple as... it's just people will, upon being told, commit atrocities. But I think if I remember correctly, with the Radiolab, it was actually quite fascinating because the conclusion that they drew is an even better story than the original story. And I haven't checked to see if that new story has been falsified, but I'm hoping it hasn't been. But the follow up is that like after the experiment has been done in all these different variations, and when they went to like interview the people who did go to 10. And say like, why did you go to 10? Most people said that they knew it was hard, but they thought they were doing it for like a greater cause, the cause of like science and stuff. And I thought that was really fascinating because like, it's not as if the Nazis like all just enjoyed shoving people into ovens, but if you think you're doing it for a greater cause, then you can increase your threshold of the kind of atrocities you're going to commit. So I don't know if that's...
They're just being good utilitarians, you know? It's just like, we need science to progress, and if this one person has to suffer and I have to turn this dial up to XXX, I think they literally had like X's on it, right? It wasn't just numbers. I think at least the original experiment literally had like up to the red zone and had like XXX. Oh my God.
Anyway, so I was going to grab another beer.
Me too.
And then get into the subject. I have no idea what the subject for today's conversation is. I'm looking forward to hear what you've been working through.
Yeah, I thought I would just float some ideas by you and see what happens. We'll just see where it goes. But it's a problem I've been thinking about recently. It was like first made clear to me a little bit by good old Aaron Stuple.
Oh, nice. Mr. Aaron from Conjecture Magazine.
So we were just talking about utilitarianism, actually. So this will it's a nice segue. So let's start. Any conversation about utilitarianism has to start with the drowning child thought experiment. It's just a requirement. Okay. So you're walking past a pond and you see a child drowning. You're wearing nice clothes, but the child's fucking drowning. So you wade in, obviously, and you save the child. And so Peter Singer first proposed this thought experiment in like a 1971 paper, I believe, called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. And at first, upon reading this, it sort of strikes one as irrelevant and pretty vacuous, right? Like, obviously you wade in and save the child if there's a child in front of you drowning in a pond. You have the power to save this child, and there you go. You wade in and save the child, you feel like a hero, and everyone goes home happy. And so from this conclusion, Singer draws a lot of morally weighty implications, right? So he argues, based on this thought experiment, that with respect to the poorest people on the planet, we are in a very similar situation. So every day we're spending money on goods and services that we don't necessarily need. This is the equivalent of like walking past the pond to spare muddying our clothes. While there are people in the world suffering from diseases that we know how to eradicate, and suffering from like hunger and malnutrition, and we know we could help them, right, just by fairly modest amounts of money, compared to like what we normally spend on maybe like luxury goods or meals or whatever. Okay, so this is kind of like a hallmark of utilitarianism, this drowning child thought experiment, and it's very compelling, especially when you have like a fixed set of actions in front of you. Okay, so you have, in this case, you're walking past the pond and there's a child drowning. And so the option A is save the child, option B is don't save the child. And those have pretty clear consequences, right? So you know what walking past the pond is going to accomplish, namely the child will die. And you know what saving the child will do, namely the child will live. So these have like very well-defined consequences that you can like project in the future. You can understand the consequences. And so you can sort of do the mental arithmetic in your head. The problem, of course, is that life decisions are very rarely this simple. Or it's not very often that there is a fixed set of choices in front of us. Namely because humans have like this creative capacity, and part of this creativity is creating new options. And so there's sort of like a paradox of utilitarianism here that says, take the action which does the most good. But if we're creating new actions and new options all the time, how can we possibly say what does the most good? Because you can't understand all the future consequences of an action without like trying it, right? Without knowing something about it. How are you going to evaluate the consequences of something that you've just like conjured up out of thin air? So you have to create the knowledge necessary to understand these consequences, but you don't know if they're going to lead to like good or bad things. And so utilitarianism, it almost like fails on its own terms here, because it wants you to like evaluate actions and take the one which leads to the most good, but you can't know what kind of good they're going to lead to. So, but then you could take this one step farther. It's not necessarily that utilitarianism can't say anything about just newly created options. It can't really say anything about anything, because if you don't understand the consequences of an action until like the end of time, how can you possibly say whether an action was like a good or bad thing? And so I was like, okay, what is going on here? Like, you have like a card-carrying utilitarian like Singer, who I really respect. Like, I view him as like a philosopher who's like really got his head on straight. When you read his pieces, he's arguing about like real problems right now about like, I think we talked about it in a previous episode, but like how to do pandemics better, how we should have had challenge trials. He's arguing about like animal rights of reducing factory farming. He's like, he's really just tackling like real world problems. And I was like, but if you take utilitarianism as foundational, as like, this is the way you need to act in the world, you kind of inevitably get into this thorny situation where you're trying to understand like all the consequences of your action. Because this is a doctrine that tells you an act is good only insofar as it brings about good consequences, right? And so now you're like, well, fuck, I have to understand those consequences. And this leads you down this like perpetual rabbit hole of understanding these consequences. So this led me thinking about like, what is the point? What is the point of a moral theory? And like, what, you know, what are they useful for? What are they trying to do? And I have come to, I think, a satisfying answer that I want to float by you. But first, I guess I should pause and see if that fucking long ass spiel made any sense and whether you have any thoughts.
Nice. Yeah. So it did make a lot of sense. And I guess an important distinction in my head that I'm now making is, let's say between a hard and a soft form of consequentialism. So the soft form of consequentialism is just when met with an ethical dilemma, you can use this consequence-based view to help make a decision. And the hard form of consequentialism, the hard form of utilitarianism, is something like, unless we know every single consequence of a given action, we cannot act. Unless we perfectly calculate every single util point of every possible set of actions, then we cannot act at all. That form of utilitarianism I don't sign on to, mainly because of the difficulties that you had just raised. It's impossible. You can never know the consequences of our actions. And so
yeah,
it's a non-starter. Yeah. The other thing that you added in was the ingredient of creating new options, right? Totally. This hard form of utilitarianism can't account for that because it deals with just, here's your decision matrix, here's your finite set of options. Yep. And now, good luck, buddy. Have fun.
Optimize,
have fun assigning.
Man, go.
Yeah,
go,
optimize. Now optimize. And so basically, I'm with you, I think. I'm totally with you. And now you said you had some new insights to add to it. I'm excited.
I think I do. We'll see if you just shut them down. Yeah, but yeah. My alternative is to try and apply the notion of falsification to moral theories. And by that, I mean to view moral theories not as prescriptive, so not as telling us like what to do in each moment, but as prohibitive, so to tell us what not to do, what courses of actions are not good. So this is, in a way, moral theories encode the knowledge of the mistakes we've learned from in the past, that certain actions tend to lead to certain consequences, and that we should be wary of acting in certain ways lest those consequences be realized. And so utilitarianism and moral theories in general are useful not as telling us optimally how to act in each moment, but they're telling us they're acting as critiques of the ways, so we in any given moment, right, we might generate tons of possible options for ourselves, right? This is what makes humans amazing, is we come up with new options all the time, and then we apply moral theories as critiques to each of those reasons. Well, you know, like I could so I'm late for my kid's birthday party. I could speed all the way home, but I also know there's like multiple playgrounds on the way home. And if I hit someone, that would be much, much worse than being five minutes late for my kid's birthday party. Okay. And you make some utilitarian argument about how the calculus works out there. But the point is utilitarianism there is serving as like a critique in the moment of how to act versus how not to act. And in particular, it's telling you, you should not act in this way because the consequences could turn out really badly. And so I want to look at moral theories, not as prescriptive, but as prohibitive. So as acting as criticisms for how not to act in any given moment. What do you think about that?
I don't like it. I don't like it. The reason I like Sam Harris's moral landscape perspective is that it's basically just, we need to reason through moral problems as they arrive. We can't come up with a moral theory in advance besides getting rid of some ones that are obviously going to lead us astray. So when I think of consequentialism as a critique, I mainly just think of it as a nice critique of bad other moral theories. But I don't take it much more seriously than that, because each moral problem that we are faced with, we're going to have to think about it on its own terms. And so the reason that I like consequentialism is just because what are we going to discuss and debate about? The consequences of various actions. So consequences are the thing which we are going to debate. And so it is the focus of debate.
Wait, I'm confused. This seems exactly like what I was saying, right? So situations are problem driven, right? And then when you're faced with a problem, there's multiple ways you could try and solve that problem, right? And then what you do is you seek criticism, whether it comes from other people or whatnot. And what moral theories provide are useful criticisms for thinking about what action you should take.
I agree. I guess I'm focusing more on the moral framework part of it, because everything you said, I agree with. And so I'm curious what the moral framework gets us, because to contextualize this a little bit, I see people within EA really spending a lot of time trying to find the right moral framework and burning a huge amount of intellectual energy figuring out what type of utilitarian they are. They're really reasoning through, like, I need to find the right framework. Do I want to be a suffering-based utilitarian, or do I want to be a pleasure-based one? And they're thinking about the framework so much that they aren't thinking about actual real-world problems. And this is one of the things that makes Peter Singer stand out, because the man has dedicated a huge amount of his time and life to thinking about real world problems.
No, that's exactly what I'm saying, right? He's using utilitarianism here. It's just using moral, he's using his like best moral explanations as criticisms of the various options. He's not trying to judge every action by utilitarian standards. He's saying there's a set of actions that people are taking in the world right now, and I'm going to judge them. I'm going to criticize them based on this moral theory that I have, known as utilitarianism, yeah, right? Yeah. So I'm criticizing the existing options with this theory, and I'm taking a stand on it, right? You don't see exactly my point. You don't see Singer wasting time trying to find the perfect solution to things based on utilitarianism. He's not using it as a foundational principle for how to act. He's using it as a criticism of existing options to say things are better than others, and I'm going to take a stand against that, right? And so usefulness of moral theories is, right? It's not, you're not trying to create the optimal action at any given point. Moral theories are a method of error correction. So they're a method of saying we have a bunch of these theories in the world that people are putting forward. Now I'm going to criticize the shit out of them with these with morality, right? So I'm claiming that morality is playing this like negative, falsificatory role instead of a guiding principle for exactly how to act in every situation. So I think we're saying the same thing, but I can't tell.
I think we are absolutely saying the same thing. I guess I'm only highlighting that, the point of a good moral theory is to use it. For example, our friend of the podcast and just friend in general, Mr. Dan, whose last name I will not use, but shout out to Dan. He pointed at this new charitable organization, which I just love. I'm going to plug it. Opus is the Organization for the Prevention of Intense Suffering. So they presumably have taken a anti-suffering based moral framework. Forgive me, Dan. I know I'm butchering the way to describe this, but on their website, which we'll link to in the show notes, they say the following, and I just love it. One of our main areas of activity has been promoting access to effective pain relief, and in particular, access to morphine for the millions of patients suffering from terminal cancer and other causes of severe pain in lower income countries. We are also focusing on cluster headaches, often described as the worst pain known to medicine, and we have produced policy papers advocating for legal access to psilocybin and related substances. Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Focusing on real-world problems, making the world better right now. This is great. This is the best. I love this. Fuck yeah. Opus. This is great. And so I guess this is a big rant to say totally. That's great. You found the right moral framework.
Yes.
And now we'll just start applying it because it's these bloody frameworks are only as good as they are able to materially increase the well-being of people on the planet right now. And to the extent that your framework allows you to think about each problem independently rather than trying to find the golden framework that will apply to every foreseeable problem in the future, to that extent, I think it's amazing.
Yeah, that's another thing I like about this. It's like it's problem driven, right? So you're like face of the problem, there are options people have taken, and now you criticize those options based on whatever. Yeah, like people who are virtue ethicists will criticize it based on that, and then we have a conversation about which one we want to pursue. But there just seems to be no way for me to reconcile like what is the point of a moral theory. I mean, there's so much literature about like moral theories tell you how to act, right? I think that's like the commonsensical notion of what a moral theory is, but because all of our actions have like unintended consequences, of course. This seems to like go out the door right away. So like, what is a moral theory for? It serves the role of like criticism. So it doesn't, it closes the door to like certain ways, or certain ideas or something, because we've found that they offer bad solutions. They're bad ideas. I can't tell if what I'm saying here is actually novel or if it's a completely mundane insight about the role of criticism. But I'll tell you what was driving me nuts is that in the conversation, actually, we fucking linked this. We might have linked this exact clip, actually, in our second episode or something. There's a conversation between Sam Harris and David Deutsch where Deutsch
makes I was just thinking about this.
He says, I want to apply... Yeah. Or no, what does he say? He draws an analogy between like between Popper's demarcation of science and metaphysics with the tool of falsifiability, and he says he wants to apply this to moral theories. And that statement has been lodged in my brain for so long, and just like I come back to it every once in a while, I'm like, what does he mean by that? Like, can you falsify a moral theory itself? Like, what does that look like? And then I was like, oh, fuck. It's not that you're falsifying the moral theories. It's that you're just using them to act as criticisms for various actions.
So, okay, I've been thinking about this too, and I have a different answer than what I had said in the second podcast episode, where, again, to try to set up for the audience, like, our two... like worldviews were just coming into fucking hard collision, and we talked past each other for frickin' ages. But it was basically on this, right? Yep. So I was reading, still am obviously Popper and Deutsch, and you were more influenced by the effective altruist way of thinking about things. But we both were consequentialists, right? And so that was what was kind of interesting. And I still think Sam Harris has the most coherent viewpoint. On this subject, and his viewpoint in a sentence is just that there is actually no real difference between moral questions and scientific questions. And the same tools that we apply in science, we apply to moral dilemmas as well. And then Deutsch comes in and says, I agree with this, yes, but I think your book... your thesis can actually be a conclusion of a deeper thesis, which is a very Deutschian thing to say. Like your entire output thesis, is really just a conclusion of my thesis.
You are a footnote.
yeah, you are a footnote, good sir. But to be fair, in terms of the profundity,
it's true. Most people are footnotes to Deutsch.
So the way that Deutsch was thinking about it was that moral. It's all just products of conjectures and refutations. But I think that I would say something different now. Now that I've read a lot of the Popperian source material myself, I'm starting to think about it actually differently than Deutsch recently. And I would unify both of these views by just saying they're just problems. You just have moral problems and you have scientific problems, but they're all just problems. And all we can do when faced with a problem is reason through it ourselves. And the way that we reason through things ourselves is through the method of conjecture and refutation, but we don't even need to use those words. We can just we try to generate a bunch of ideas and then ask our friends to think about them too, and ask our friends to try to spot holes in them. But at no point can we ever evade having to think for ourselves. That's, I think, the main thing that unifies their various perspectives. And Sam saying that it's just science is basically saying that we just use the same reasoning tools for moral problems as we do for scientific ones. It's all just like, there's a kid drowning and we need to fucking solve that problem. And one way to do it is to run in. Another way to do it is to build a fence around the lake so that children don't run into the drowning lake anymore. But it's just a problem. All we are ever faced with are problems. And so I actually don't make a strong distinction between scientific and moral problems anymore. I don't know. Is that satisfying or unsatisfying?
No, I mean, it's satisfying. It is what I'm trying to get to. I'm just saying, like, what moral theories do is they serve as the refutations there. They serve as a form of criticism instead of a shining beacon of light towards which we should all guide, because there's no way to say what Bill Gates's founding of Microsoft would have done before he did it and whether or not he should have done it.
Here's maybe a way to sharpen my question. Do you think that people need to first develop a moral theory in order to participate in the conversation of criticism? Or do you think that anyone can do it without having first spent a good amount of time choosing their moral theory?
No, of course anyone can do it. I'm just saying, pointing out that five people are going to suffer in one case and one person's going to suffer in another case is like a very powerful form of criticism.
Totally. Gotcha. Excellent. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. And I think like Singer did this as well. And he's talking about how he wants to not only count lives lost, but actually count years lost for given actions. Yep. So he makes the case that, I think he's in his 70s, that if he was to die, that's less of a crime than if someone who's in their 20s was to die. And that is an interesting way to think about things. And you can see quite clearly how his utilitarianism led him to challenge a widely held assumption of society, that we should count lives lost and not years lost. And that's interesting. It's a good place to start a debate, I think. I'm not advocating, I don't think I'm totally on board one way or the other yet, but I think it's a really interesting place to start thinking and see what conclusions we can draw.
Yeah, generalization of this is known as like qualies. So you try and think about like the quality adjusted life years that would be lost for various actions. And like quality adjusted means adjusted for like disability levels or like animals.
So the quality thing is interesting because it seems to me that there is a dangerous temptation to start trying to find the perfect framework always, like the quality doll. I think it was like a dollies as well. And now people start arguing about like what's the exact best way to quantify this, and now we've stopped thinking about real world problems, and now we switch back into trying to find the perfect way to quantify stuff and the perfect framework to use to apply to different circumstances again. And to the extent that people stop thinking about real world problems like cluster headaches or pain relief, like morphine access, like specific concrete instances, they stop thinking about that and they start thinking about how should we define our dolly? How should we define our quali? Then we're not thinking about the real world anymore. We're not thinking about problems in the real world. We're thinking about developing a better framework. And that seems to be a risk.
Well, I don't know. There's something super suspicious about that. Like, not you can. It seems like you can always, that critique is so easy to level at anything, right? You could say, well, as soon as you're trying to find any sort of parsimony, you've left the real world and you're no longer trying to solve real problems. It's instead of thinking about dollies and qualies, just like take it one step backwards. Like before, thinking people were talking about life years, right? So you just argued that was a great way to think about certain problems, right? So before that occurred to anyone, you might have said, oh, now when we're thinking about, instead of just lives lost, we're thinking about the number of live years lost. Now that this is too abstract, where, you know, we're getting too, there's gotta be room for thinking about, okay, what sort of general, solutions are we coming to with these problems? Like what sort of arguments are useful? What is it about those arguments that is useful? And I mean, like one of your intellectual idols is like all about this, right? Deutsch's whole thing is like, what makes an explanation good, right? This is the land of the abstract, right? And so a part of his whole thing is like an explanation that applies to everything that's easy to vary is a bad explanation, right? And so I could say, oh, you've left the land of thinking about individual problems, right? Now you're just telling me in the abstract what makes a good solution. Like, I don't want this parsimonious bullshit. Like, I want to think problem by problem. But like, there's got to be room for just like, we're developing thinking tools. We're developing modes of criticism for thinking about things. Like, that seems totally fine to me. I don't know.
I totally take, yeah, excellent point. You're right. That's, like, actually, as you were looking for an example, I was like, on my browser screen is a perfect counterexample. I really like your point there. Because so I was just raving about Opus, right? And their focus on cluster headaches. Presumably they got there first by spending a lot of time thinking about what ethical framework do they want to focus on? Oh, they want to focus on suffering. What's a good way to emphasize that? Well, suffering, what causes a lot of suffering? Cluster headaches. So then they go down to the real world and apply it. So excellent, excellent point. Maybe a refinement to what I said earlier is something like we should continuously test out our frameworks on real world problems to see if they're any good. So I think that's a better refinement because you're absolutely right. We have to think theoretically. We can't only be applying things to the real world, but in order to make sure we haven't totally detached ourselves from the real world, we need to test our theories on the real world as a way to get feedback, I guess. Is
nice. I like that. Yeah. Because now you're judging things by how well they solve problems. Right. And so I don't care how you came with the idea. If you want to come up with it because it's like super parsimonious and you think in terms of qualies and dollies, like that's fine to me. The question is like, what are you advocating as solutions to certain problems? Nice. And now we can judge that. Right. And if that's super useful, then fine. Keep thinking about things like that. And why like thinking about the consequences of our actions until the end of time is not useful is because precisely it doesn't allow us to solve any problems. Right. Like forget about the inherent like value or something of the moral theory. The problem with it is like if it doesn't allow you to solve problems, it's useless, right? We need to be able to solve problems. Dude,
great. Nice. Yeah. Yes. I love it. That was a much more refined way to say what I was awkwardly saying earlier. And it might be a nice thing for us to all ask ourselves if we've spent a lot of time trying to come up with the right moral theory. Mm. When was the last time we applied it in practice?
Nice.
Like, when was the last time all of this thinking about utils and dollies and qualies and consequences and what the right flavor of blah, blah, blah. Like, okay, fine. Think about that. But when was the last time you applied it in the real world? And I guess when I had asked, like, do you have an example of the last time you had...
I couldn't give you one.
worked... But I think it's maybe a good exercise for everyone who is in the EA space and thinking about this a lot to think like, when was the last time you used any of this to solve a real world problem? And if the answer is recently, then keep going. That's great. but it is a good sanity check because I guess what I was trying to say earlier is something like, and this happens in every academic discipline. Like you just have some people who just go off into theory land and never come down.
Exactly.
And that's okay. It's okay sometimes. It's okay in like math. But if you're dealing with ethical frameworks, you need to freaking come down because the whole point of an ethical framework is that it should improve the way that human beings relate to each other.
I think I agree more strongly than you even just put it. But I just think math is a bad analogy. I think you say you're off in theory land in math, you're drawing an unnecessary distinction between like mathematical problems and real world problems. But theoretical math still deals with specific examples, right? So when you're doing mathematical research,
really nice.
And this is actually something that occurred to me when you were talking last time is like when I'm doing mathematical research, it's very rare. It's funny. This is one of the lessons I actually learned early on trying to do like research in theory was like you have to be tied to examples. Because it's so easy to just start doing random shit on paper that looks fucking cool. And you're like, this is right. And then you apply it to an example and you're like, this doesn't make any sense. Anyway, this is a long-winded way of saying I completely agree. But the math example, I think, is a bad one because even very theoretical math is still tied to problems in that discipline, right? Like there's no theoretical math that like fails to solve, like contradicts some known mathematical example,
ooh,
right? Yeah.
Ooh, dude. Ooh. Let's even say instead of saying mathematical example, let's say toy problems,
right?
Because that generalizes to like moral problems as well, right? So let's move the subject ever so slightly to this idea of toy ethical examples, because it seems to me
interesting
that this leads us to problems quite quickly. Specifically, the drowning child example is interesting because I was just about to say, can you apply it to the drowning child case? But then I caught myself because that is a shitty example because that has very little bearing on the real world.
Interesting. Okay.
Because just like you said, like when has anyone ever been wearing a fancy suit and walked past a drowning child? And like this doesn't actually map onto stuff that happens in the real world very often. I know he's, so to be fair, Singer would obviously recognize that. And he would say it's not about real world cases. It's about like playing with your ethical intuitions and do you really need like a new Lamborghini and can you take that money and put it globally, et cetera, et cetera. So all those caveats aside, I recognize that. The case remains that the thing you started with is that the drowning child example is actually kind of misleading in the sense that it uses as an implicit assumption the fixed choice hypothesis. You only have a fixed number of choices. Right. You can either run in or run out, or run in or keep walking. And that obviously is not true. That is a violation of reality because we never have fixed choices. Even if you're trying to take your ethical or your 10% and donate to a fixed amount of charities, even that's not a fixed choice because you could take it and give it to your children, or you could do 1,000 different things. So even in the financial allocation space, when it may appear like you have a fixed choice, you don't. You always can do other things.
Good point. Yeah.
And so I don't know what to do with this except that it seems like a danger of the toy example or a danger of the thought experiment because it, and I know that like Parfit's work is just clogged with all of this stuff. It's just toy example after toy example, which I am not a fan of, but I haven't been able to pinpoint why. So that's a lot of spouting and see what you do with that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So would you rather, to clarify, would rather that Parfit's work, for example, or even the Singer drowning child example was more realistic? Is that what, like, would you be more on board if it was like he was pulling examples from real life or no?
No. Okay. Great question. What am I trying to say here? So I guess first thing I'm trying to say is there is a hazard with these examples in that they appear like they're capturing something in reality, but often they presuppose things which are really important. So I think the strongest I would want to say is like there's a hazard. I don't think I could go much further than that. But then I guess the other thing I want to say is that these examples are great if they're for idea generation, but ultimately they're not the same thing as working on cluster headaches, or they're not the same thing as taking a public position on human challenge trials. And so the hazard. So let me suggest two hazards. Hazard one is these toy examples can be unintentionally misleading. And hazard two is we can become obsessed with toy examples to the point where we stop working on cluster headaches. And the obsession thing is something I say only based on reading way too much effective altruism literature for a healthy mind. And so these are my vague intuitions that you need to sharpen by just shooting them down
there's something here. There's something very interesting here. Like what are the point of toy examples in the moral philosophy space? Is your worry, could it be framed something like this? Look, it is very easy to come up with toy examples that contradict any like complete moral theory, say. And so now, instead of taking these arguments that come from these moral theories and applying them to real cases, we spend all our time trying to find some unified theory that solves all of these cases. But because these cases, it's like there's something like it's not because it's not tied to the world. There are infinitely many ways to change the setting, to change the problem such that it can contradict like any reasonable principle you throw at it that could be very, it could be applied in real life with great success, but it will never, there's no principle that will withstand all these thought experiments because there's infinitely many degrees of freedom to play with because it's not constrained by anything except our imagination. So now instead, and so because we're like preoccupied with coming up with like ultimate moral theories, or if we are preoccupied with this, now we spend all our time arguing about some, trying to find some great unified principle instead of just taking like pretty good moral theories that just like say interesting things that serve as good criticism, serve as good arguments, instead of applying those to the world so we can start making progress on problems, we're just like arguing in the clouds.
I think that's pretty excellent. Now you've read Reasons of Persons.
I have, yeah.
Right? Is it not the case that it's just one toy example refuting another toy example, refuting another toy example, refuting another toy example to the extent where none of it really ties to the real world? And at the end, it's just a collection of toy examples all refuting one another. Am I mischaracterizing it or no?
I mean, he comes to some conclusions. So he thinks like but let me give you what you want. Like, so he does come to some general conclusions, but what he is trying to do is come up with some like moral principle that is able to withstand all of these examples.
So, don't give me what I want, because when I said what I was saying earlier, I kind of had Reasons and Persons in mind.
Yeah.
As this gone wrong. So, if some interesting conclusions have come out of it, then that I'll take that as falsifying a good amount of what I said earlier. In the sense that, so I didn't read the whole thing. I flipped through it in the course of an afternoon. But I also heard somebody on, I think the Finneluka's Here This Idea podcast talking about how, like, they read Reasons of Persons, the best book they've ever read, and they feel like they may, like, there's no conclusions that they could draw from it or something to this extent. And they're like, well, this sounds like utter fucking hell, but if people like it, then people like it. And then so I flipped through it, and it was just he just made thought experiments that then he would refute in the second section, which would then be triply refuted, quadruply refuted. And so what comes of this? What has come of this that I'm missing?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a personal thing for the reader. For me, it was valuable in thinking about, because like for the reader, certain thought experiments are going to be more persuasive than others. Certain criticisms, certain arguments will be more persuasive than others. For me, it did a lot to, I think, advance my thinking of like how to think about like the self and personhood throughout time, and like how much I value like myself compared to others, compared to my future self, like this sort of thing. And so that was super valuable for me. But I do agree totally that there's like one, it's super hard to read. And I know people will like give it a pass and say, well, Parfit's such a deep thinker, and so, of course, you should expect his book to hard to read. And that is a terrible argument. If he's a deep thinker, then he should be able to write well. Yeah.
Like, exactly. This is like the biggest public service announcement that we should ever make, which is the deeper the thinker, the clearer the writing.
Yeah, yeah.
My God. Like, the more intelligent the thinker, then the simpler the writing should be. And it's always the exact fucking opposite. I apologize for swearing, but this is one of my
biggest
annoyances in the world, is that like terrible writing makes the reader feel stupid.
Yeah.
Terrible writing gives the impression that the author's a fucking genius and that you, the reader, are just cowering in their intellect, and it's so bad. And sorry, this is a complete tangent, but
I totally agree. He's not a good writer. And because of that, I have to think he's not a super clear thinker. Anyway, people will freak out at that, I'm sure, but like then write a better book. But anyway, like so he's got like four huge sections, and like you know, some of the sections I think were nonsense, but his section on like personhood I thought was super valuable. So I'm definitely not the person you want to have to like utterly defend the book. Like, I got some nice ideas out of it that like I apply but that's it.
So that was a super honest and great answer to I think some of my concerns. So these like sequence of thought experiments can be great for ideation. So for just like, you hadn't thought about, you said personhood over time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I haven't thought about that either. And so that is a big point for just the importance of these kinds of thought experiments, which is like, they can make you think about things that you hadn't thought about before. And that's excellent. And so that's already, I think, a strike against what I was saying earlier, which is that they're always, no, that was too strong, but just the fact that you got something out of it is evidence to the fact that there is value in these kinds of thought experiments. So going back to like the reality thing before I derailed it with the reasons and persons, like maybe it's just the danger of doing this instead of applying to real world problems, or like not having an equal mix of both. And like the whole long-termism business is like this is my biggest concern with it, is that they're just talking about outer space governance and Mars and not focusing on the here and now. And then the strong reply to what I just said is like, well, we need to have both, obviously. And of course we do. We need to have people thinking about Mars and thinking about outer space. And so there's maybe like a sense of proportion thing that's happening that I'm missing as well. I don't know.
Yeah, it is hard. I like that we're talking about this, because I feel like my thinking can really, there's a problem to be solved here, I think, which is nice. Part of me thinks that the problem is that there's just like a roller coaster of, you can always come up with the next problem in just like idea space. And so if you're not careful, you stop trying to find good enough solutions to real problems and making progress that way. And you try and find like better and better and more optimal solutions to hypothetical problems, which, you know, given infinite time or whatever, maybe is valuable. But the fact is that we have to solve real problems to make like, but I don't want to, there's something about like, I want to claim that the knowledge we get from solving real problems is somehow more substantial, but maybe that's not true. And then I also have to define like what a real problem is, which seems it seems like a non-starter.
There's maybe an analogy to draw with, say, doing science without testing,
right?
Because hypothesizing about how the world works is fantastic. We absolutely need that. But if we're going to see if any of these hypotheses are any good, we have to eventually apply them somewhere, where I use the word apply, not test, just to be as general as possible. Yeah. Similarly with math and with philosophy, you can ideate all day, but unless you apply some of these ideations to concrete, say, let's keep it in the domain of science, making predictions and then having the real world falsify those predictions, then you don't know which of your ideas are any good. In the space of math, you ideate and then you apply them to certain sets of toy examples and you see if these theories work. In the space of philosophy, you apply it to philosophical problems. Popper would come up with all sorts of crazy theories, and then a very common thing he would do is say, like, in order to see if any of this is any good, I'm going to apply this theory to some well-known problems in philosophy, etc. And so I see like Parfit doing the first half. He's doing the ideation. That's great. Now we need to come down and need to apply it to stuff. And so the OPIS people, Organization for the Prevention of Intense Suffering, the OPIS people are doing this in an amazing way, where they're applying their suffering-based ethics to cluster headaches. I had no idea what cluster headaches were. Presumably, this would not be a worked-on problem had there not been a group of people who were focused on trying to find that which causes the most amount of suffering medically.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so they like they took this framework and they said, okay, well, we need to research. We need to find the thing that's the most painful. And then they found cluster headaches, and then they started working on that problem. And that's amazing. That's great. Like, I can't imagine anybody working on the cluster headache problem had it not been for a suffering-based ethics, right. Presumably. Besides Tylenol and Advil, but they're not focusing on cluster headaches. And so there's something there, I think, about the coming down from theory land and applying it to real-world problems in order to see if your ideation is any good, if all of these ideas you've come up with are valid in any way. And so in that sense, maybe I have to retract a lot of what I said about Derek Parfit, because if he's just doing the first half, there's value there. But then we need to make sure to do the second half, or at least know that the job's not done until both are attempted, something like that. I don't know.
I do think there's something interesting here where, like, some philosophers are so guided by these thought experiments and endless variations of these thought experiments. And like the trolley problem is another example here, right? Where like people write books and essays and like variations on the trolley problem. Another example is those Gettier cases for justified true belief. That's another one of these problem thought experiments where people are like, well, you know, and so, you know, what? I don't want to, they're definitely not serving a purpose, but are they actually generating knowledge? Like, are they telling us things that are useful to solve problems? It depends on the case, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. What do you got?
There's also a big difference between the kinds of thought experiments which, say, Einstein used to...
Oh, great fucking example.
Prove that, like, the speed of light can't be constant, depending on the velocity of the mover, like a single photon in a train or what have you. I don't know if you.
Yeah. And him like riding on a light beam or whatever.
Yeah. And so like, what is it about those thought experiments that just really clarify things, compared to thought experiments that seem to just be forever, like you're always able to generate, like there's also, it's difficult to come up with Einstein's thought experiment. Right. But what makes it difficult?
Well, I mean, but also his thought experiments didn't prove anything, right? They were the impetus for him to start formalizing certain ideas, right? They provided like a powerful intuition for him to then formalize his ideas, to apply them to the world, right? It was entirely possible in the world pre-1918, whenever the Eddington experiments were done, for his thought experiments to be powerfully intuitive, right? And like for him, I'm sure he was convinced of his ideas, right? Like I think you have to be to like put forward a theory like that, right? It has to make like complete intuitive sense to you. But it was possible, I'm using possible in a weird way here, but it was possible for him to be convinced of his ideas and then have them proved wrong, right? So he was using thought experiments conducively to then check them against the world. He wasn't using them as a proof in and of themselves.
Nice. Okay. So there is something about the power of storytelling, where rather than writing a bunch of formula, if you can communicate by talking about like objects moving around space,
right,
then the visual centers of our brain just immediately intuit it much better when you can visualize stuff moving in three-dimensional space. You can feel walking past a drowning child and wearing a tuxedo. Like these are very visual metaphors. And then like running into the water, you can like almost feel the like water, like the resistance on your legs, right? Like it's a very intuitive thing. And so a thought experiment can perhaps serve the role of giving intuition about an already formed theory to somebody else. And it can also serve the role of allowing you to start coming up with a more precise theory. In the case of Einstein, I guess. And I guess maybe the strongest thought experiment that I know of might have come from Galileo. Like, you know, the whole like story of him dropping like something heavy and something light and showing that like, so I guess that didn't actually happen, but the true story is better because he's trying to refute the idea that things which are heavier fall faster.
Right.
And I think he refutes it entirely using a thought experiment. And if I can remember it, it goes something like this where, let's suppose that this is true. So let's suppose that heavy things fall faster than light things. And now take a heavy thing, take a light thing, and attach them with a chain and drop them. So if the heavy thing falls faster than the light thing, then you would expect the chain to be taut. But as soon as it's taut, then it's a singular object that is now falling at the same rate, right? So if it's falling at the same rate, then the top and the bottom have to be moving at the same, the whole thing has to be moving at the same speed. Something to this effect. So it's a proof by contradiction. The only way that this could take place is if they fall at the same rate. Because once you attach two objects, they become a singular object. And do you consider that to be two objects falling at different rates, or do you consider it to be the same object? So there's also this ingredient of like constructing thought experiments using your opponent's assumptions, and then showing using purely your opponent's assumptions that their favorite conclusion cannot follow. Where one of the moves that are allowed with thought experiments that can lead us to trouble, I think, is that we're allowed to make any kind of simplifying assumption we like, right? So we are free to simplify the problem however we want. And that is dangerous power put in the hands of the wrong person, because now we can just simplify to our heart's content. And so I think in the case of both Einstein and Galileo, they were careful not to simplify in a way that would make their story easier. The simplifying assumptions were always against their favorite theory. So there's something about
like an adversarial simplification.
Yeah, an adversarial simplification. Fucking exactly, Matt. Exactly. Yes, because like if I'm putting forth my theory and I give you a thought experiment that makes my theory look freaking great, and then you have your own theory and you make your own thought experiment that makes your theory look great, now we're just trading thought experiments that aren't talking to each other, because neither of us are playing with the other person's assumptions, right?
Yeah, interesting. It's like you want to form, you want to make the thought experiment as strict as possible so that as few assumptions as possible are needed to like show that it's wrong, or it or the other way around, or something like that. So you need to make it as
criticizable as possible.
As criticizable as possible. Right. Maybe. Oh, interesting. I wonder if that's what's happening with some of these thought experiments. Like, they're becoming so mundane that like any theory applies to it, but you don't notice, because if you're just applying one theory to it, then that's like all you have going on. But you, what you've done is watered it down enough so that like anything can really apply to this thing. So is that applicable to Singer's thought experiment? Is it too?
So Singer's thought experiment does simplify in a way that is favorable to his case,
because you know,
but is that okay?
Like exactly what's going on.
So I guess one of the biggest simplifications is that you only have two choices available to you: keep walking or dive in. And that's obviously not the case.
Right, you can
call for help. You could take your suit off and then run in. Like, Jesus, that's the simplest
one. Especially because what he's trying to apply it to is like global poverty and stuff, and there it's like so clear that the cases are, if the choice is not binary.
Okay, good. So then, to add what I was saying earlier, so there he has a theory, and perhaps he's using this thought experiment as a communication tool.
Right.
So like, so this isn't the bulk of his argument. The bulk of his argument is that we aren't giving enough to prevent needless suffering when we are pouring money into luxury goods, when we could be putting some of that money into fighting malaria. Right. And that is completely, of course, that's a really important message to convey. And so his thought experiment is more taking the form of a communication tool, I think. It's a very visceral way to convey that core idea.
I see.
If you just like say it in the abstract, it's not going to land. But if you make it concrete and specific, it's going to have more resonance with the listener.
Interesting. Okay, so are you, in general, trying to put thought experiments in sort of two camps? One is sort of the communication camp, like just getting across an idea. Let's like simplify a lot of assumptions. Here's just in general what I'm trying to say. And then the other camp is like a refutation camp, where you say like this can't possibly be right because consider this situation. Is that roughly?
I don't know what I'm trying to do. I guess I'm trying to take well-known thought experiments and study what makes them effective.
Right.
So yeah. I don't yet have a thesis. It's more just like, what is it about Singer and Einstein and Galileo to compare the three? What about these thought experiments is working? And why is it working? And so I think the communication part is definitely key, because sometimes, like, so in my, I tried to combine both of these actually with my little thought experiment in the credence assumption.
Oh, nice.
Post,
okay.
Right?
Yeah. This is good.
Right.
Yeah.
So both of these theories were kind of operating in the background, right? Where I tried to make something very visceral, very visual, that also only used the opponent's assumptions.
Right.
So only using their assumptions, was I able to show that it led to a undesirable conclusion. Rob, who listens to the podcast, and so, hey, Rob, fucking hated that thought experiment. So I don't know if it was successful or not, but maybe his hatred was exactly what I was trying to tease out of it. But these are the two things I was thinking about when I was kind of coming up with that thing. I don't think this is a criterion of demarcation or what have you. We can't just strike out thought experiments based on these two observations, obviously, but then maybe the third observation is just what you said, reading Reasons and Persons, which sometimes they're just like fun to think about and they give you new ideas, right? And we can't discount that role either. Like, it just makes you think about different stuff, and that's great. And so we have to recognize that.
Yeah, I think that's one thing worth emphasizing, is that the line here between thought experiment and just thought in general and counterfactual is a little bit loose, right? Like, when you're considering what we should have done with respect to challenge trials and COVID-19, is that a thought experiment? Are you just thinking about the counterfactual? Like, what is that? And so there's a way in which like these all kind of get folded into one another that I'm a little bit uncomfortable with and not sure how to think about. Yeah. I mean,
So here's a better question. When could thought experiments lead us astray? So we talked about maybe good aspects of thought experiments, some things that they do well, but when can they go too far? Or too far is a weird way to phrase it. When can they stop being helpful, or when can they actively impede progress?
I don't have anything deep to say, so I'll just give you an example of one that has slowly started driving me nuts, which is what I mentioned earlier, actually, which is like the trolley problems, which I just find so exceptionally unhelpful now that I can't even handle it when like books bring them up or people bring them up, because it's just... there's something about it where it's just like, it's kind of the same as the drowning child a little bit, that just denies us the opportunity to solve the problem in another way, right? It's like, you are constrained in this situation. You either push the person off the bridge, there's a fat dude in front of you and you push him off the bridge, or you don't push him off the bridge, and we know exactly what the consequences are. And it like puts you in this thought experiment land, this like hypothetical land that is just like so divorced from how I think people generally think about problems and the uncertainty that goes with it and the possibility of creating new options, that is like so unhelpful that I can't claim that it's like done more harm than good, but I don't think it's doing much in the way of like helping us solve real problems.
Ooh, interesting. Ooh, okay, this is good. So maybe there's something like So if we tentatively take the assumption that like thought experiments are good for communication tools, for say working with your opponent's assumptions and for ideation, then all of those seem very intuitively plausible. But then you can have thought experiments which are just starting to become overused, right? So if they become incorporated into the culture and like everyone knows what the bloody trolley problem is, and then we come up with 500 different variations of trolley problems, and I refute your trolley problem with trolley problem variation 63, and then you give me trolley problem variation 64, then what are we doing? So now we're not even talking to each other, really. We're just like exchanging thought experiments.
Yep.
There's no real ideation happening besides just coming up with new thought experiments. So we're not really like attached to reality, or that's maybe too strong, but and also there's like the whole visual communication tool is kind of lost as well, because Singer wouldn't use the a drowning, like two children, and he wouldn't use like, okay, now there's one drowning child and you're wearing a Rolex, and okay, now there's four drowning children and you're wearing a nice suit, but your hat is not nice. Like, he wouldn't keep doing this because it's not
interesting,
providing any more intuition for his theory anymore, right? Like, it's like there's like a one hit effect that comes, that comes from it. But I think one of the big problems is this like talking past each other by exchanging thought experiments.
Interesting.
And I've noticed this on like the EA forum quite a lot, where like just one probabilistic thought experiment met with another one, met with a third one, met with a fourth one, and now we're like, what are we even doing? We're just making shit up and using it to talk past each other. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's something with the easy to, it's too easy to change, right? But the reason I'm struggling is because I don't want to say it's not constrained by anything, because the fucking point of a thought experiment is that it's not constrained by anything, right? That's like literally the point. It's hard for me to say like, oh, by iterating on the thought experiments, you're not constrained by reality, because that's the fucking point. But there's a way in which you can like navigate through any obstacle course of criticism just by varying different parts of it, because it's thought experiment. Like,
or maybe there's something like the more constraints you add to your thought experiment, the better it becomes. Like, it's not a Boolean or something, but like as it becomes more and more constrained by only using your opponent's assumptions, having to make it map onto reality is like, that's what one of the things that made Einstein's experiments so excellent, right? Is like, it's trains and photons. Like, this is as real as we could possibly get. And so there's nothing made up. Like, all of the assumptions that he made were just to abstract away irrelevant details from the problem. Like, the train is moving at a constant velocity rather than accelerating and decelerating and hitting bumps. And he's not going to consider the bumps in the train. It's like, he's constrained by reality. And what he simplifies out don't change the core problem under consideration, which is the velocity of the photon in relation to the moving train.
Right. So would you say a general useful heuristic here is like the fewer steps you're making away from reality, the better your thought experiment is going to be.
Or maybe reality gives some constraints, right? Yeah. Your opponent's arguments give other constraints. So working as much as possible with what your opponent thinks is valid. And like, so in Singer's case, what's the opponent? The opponent, like, I guess non-utilitarian ethics. And so he's kind of fighting almost against like this common sense thing. That's vague. I don't think we can make hard and fast rules about what is, but I think that we can come up with certain like heuristics that will, like, we can never accuse other people of not following our heuristics, but when we ourselves are using the tool of thought experiments to improve our own thinking in the way that it
does. Nice. Yeah. I mean, so and now I'm trying to think of some of the most useful thought experiments I've come across, which is like, the one that pops to mind is honestly the free will one, where you ask me to consider a movie or something, right? Like, pick your favorite movie, examine that process, like what happened. And I think it's so powerful because, is that even a thought experiment though? Not really.
There's something weird there, because it's actually trying to look at the process of thoughts coming into your head.
Right. It's, yep.
Like, that is a uniquely strange case, because you're actually running an experiment,
yeah, like running with your thoughts, your brain.
Yeah, it's a thought experiment in the most literal possible.
Okay, yeah, that's a bad example. Right? Yeah. Interesting. I guess probably the reason why I find it so compelling, though, right? Is because it's so tied to reality that it's like, oh,
yeah, exactly.
I could not have chosen a night at the Roxbury. Yeah. You are correct.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. This is definitely, I think Popper wrote about this actually in The Logic of Scientific Discovery at the end. Mm. So some of the stuff that I've been saying about like using your opponent's assumptions comes from.
So is this like PostScript stuff or?
No, it's actually, I think in the original one, Logic of Scientific Discovery in the, like, at the end of it.
Okay, nice,
I'll see if I can find it, but I don't know.
I don't know either.
well, to fucking be continued, I guess. Like, this was a fun speculative episode, and hopefully, with a heavy amount of editing, it will be listenable.
Yeah, exactly. People are no doubt screaming at us. This is the ingredient, you morons.
I mean, if anything, like, we are just trying to reason through things live, and it is fucking hard, but I don't know.
A thought experiment for the audience. If you were us, what would you have said?
What thought experiment would you have
said? Exactly.
All right, man. Well, this was a fun... weird random ass episodes, but I liked it.
All right, the next one will be more properly researched, I swear to God. We were both just a little caught off guard with this one, so that's what happened.